I mean, quality comes from quantity. You know, writers will tell you they're not writers, they're rewriters, and writing over and over again. And so almost everything you do is something that you will get better at. One of the things that's very hard to judge your own work, but the only way to really judge it is for that to be a lot of work to judge over time. A lot of work. So quality comes from quantity.
Hello and welcome to the podcast, 10 Lessons It Took Me 50 Years to Take Two. Hello and welcome to the podcast.
Want me to do this for you?
Maybe you could introduce yourself, maybe easier. Try it again. Hello and welcome to the podcast, 10 Lessons It Took Me 50 Years to Learn, where we dispense wisdom for your career and your life. My name is Duff Watkins and I'm your host. Today, our guest is legendary cartoonist Bob Mankoff. Bob is a guy who started off okay in life, comes from a good family, had a good education, and somehow just took a strange turn and ended up as a cartoonist. Bob, how does anybody end up as a cartoonist?
Well, I was draft dodging for a while in the 60s by going to school and then eventually going for a PhD in psychology. And I was on the cusp of my PhD, but it was the world's longest cusp. And I never finished it. And I had, in New York City when I was growing up, there were a number of specialized schools. There was the Bronx Hall High School of Science. There was Brooklyn Tech for engineers, and there was a high school of music and art for musicians and artists. And these were schools that you actually had to get into, you know? And I lived in Queens, and the school was in Manhattan, and I showed my portfolio because as a kid, I was always drawn. Started to draw sort of funny pictures early on, and I got into the high school of music and art. So that was sort of the start of it. But once I got into high school of music and art, they had selected the best artists from all over the city. And I was definitely not the best artist from all over the city. And so I sort of took a 10-year detour, partly helped by the 60s. But happily, all those people who were better artists than me ended up being dentists. And it worked out for me. But I had drawn early and I had drawn funny things and I took this detour in the 60s, Vietnam War, avoiding it, getting a PhD in almost PhD in psychology. And then at 30, I heard the clock tick really hard and fast. And I said, you know what, I'm going to do this. And I just dropped everything. Fire burned in my head. I had all these ideas. I told you maybe that in 67, when I really got out of college, I went around to magazines in New York and I had done 27 cartoons. And I thought 27 cartoons is the most cartoons you can do in the world. And I got them all rejected. And that rejection at that time floored me enough that I didn't go back. But long story long, longish, that's sort of how I got to be a cartoonist. Oh, by the way, I'm funny. And I can draw.
That helps.
Yeah. And I can't do that much else. So,
well, let me explain to people. Now, you submitted 500 cartoons to the New Yorker, which is like the standard in the United States and maybe in many other Western countries. And 500 before you got one accepted. Now that turned into a 20-year career as a cartoonist for them. Then another 20-year as editor of the cartoon department or whatever it is.
Sure.
And then you let them, went to Esquire, wrote some books, started some businesses, all that sort of stuff. So you've had quite an esteemed career in it. You know, we've had two people on the show, Bob, who wanted to be astronauts. We've had CEOs, ambassadors, but we've never had a cartoonist before. So we're making history.
Yeah, well, I actually wanted to play center field for the New York Yankees, but that didn't pan out. And I got good feedback almost as starters when I became a cartoonist. I wasn't getting into the New Yorker, but I was getting published elsewhere. Mm-hmm. So first, I think if that didn't happen, I wouldn't have continued. But the fact that it's an enormous kind of validation. Remember, this is 73, 74. that this magazine doesn't exist, in a Saturday Review of Literature, and the editor there was Norman Cousins, who was sort of a big deal literary guy, wrote a book about humor and the fact that, you know, all of a sudden you go from nothing to being in a magazine, to seeing your name there, shows you can do it. You know what I mean? It shows you, and I think we mentioned this before, if no one anywhere at any time, for whatever reason, will open their wallet to pay for your work, you probably should look for other work. But right away I found that, you know what? Some people would pay me for it, and that was a huge, huge charge. Mm. And then I had to forget about the odds. I mean, I didn't say this is one of the lessons, but there's sometimes where you have to, hey, what are the odds? This doesn't make sense. And when you're young or youngish, you have to say, fuck the odds. It's a long shot, but fortune favors the long shot with enough effort. Doesn't mean it's going to happen, but you know what I mean? You know, and so that's the fact that I got some feedback. And also, I think I said to you, I mean, one of my lessons was more harm is done by respect than disrespect. I mean that in general, even in terms of satire and all sorts of things. Authority has enough things going for it. You know what I mean? It's got the trumpets. It's got hail to the chief. It's got everything. You don't have to respect authority. You know, that's its coin of the realm.
Well,
let me
cut in there and get to the lesson, because I think your career is a testimony of persistence and perseverance. The first lesson you talk about is work in batches of 10. And really, the more we talk, it's work, think, and live in batches of 10. So what do you mean by that?
I mean, quality comes from quantity. You know, writers will tell you they're not writers, they're rewriters, and writing over and over again. And every, you know, almost everything you do is something that you will get better at. And so one of the things, it's very hard to judge your own work. But the only way to really judge it is for there to be a lot of work to judge over time. A lot of work. You know what I mean? You do one cartoon. Okay, I judge that. When I come back the next day, I judge it. I'm still judging the same thing. So quality comes from a quantity. Creativity comes from quantity. Bad ideas are the way stations to good ideas by iteration, you know? And, you know, if I'd say, I mean, I think that another thing I said, you know, originality is overrated. So often when you do something which has been done before, but slightly different, and it's not that really much better, but it's a little bit different. It's different enough so that it makes somebody laugh. So when people ask me, well, how do you know this is different enough from that? I said, well, because you saw the other thing and still laughed at this. Okay, it's different enough. But by gradations, you can move from these differences to something that's completely original. But to do that, you have to have produced a lot of stuff. If you try to be original from the start, you'll be original in a mannerist way as an affectation. But sometimes you can get to a kind of originality or your voice. So that's the other thing. Why do 10 things? You'll find out who you are in this medium, and you can't find that out except by lots of work. Jack Ziegler, who's a great cartoonist from New Yorker, passed away a couple of years ago, said he didn't think he really learned how to do it till he had done 3,000 cartoons. So that's the lesson. 3,000.
3,000. So the point is, I mean, you were saying to me, or I read it somewhere, that most ideas are bad. 9 out of 10 things that we try fail. So you have to think in terms of, well, batches.
Yeah, most ideas are, okay, bad is strong, and most ideas might be bad. Then you have the subset that's mediocre. Then you have the subset that's not good enough, not bad at all. Not there. So you have to get in a field of talents to the apex of ideas. And that's why, by that definition, they're bad or not good enough. I just had someone, people send me all the time, hey, I'm so-and-so, I write comedy, do you have a cartoonist who, you know, here are some of my gags. I didn't get back to this guy yet. And I'm never rude. I'm never rude. If I go to the Midwest, I'm automatically rude because I'm from New York.
Can I get a second opinion on the rudeness?
I'm not rude. I'm just honest. You know what I mean? I give you an example. I mean, I told you I'm a Jewish background and I've been married 3 times. Just keeps getting better and better. But my last third and best wife, Cora Scott Whittier, not Jewish, WASPy, and so when we were courting or dating, she said, "Why are you arguing with me?" I said, "I'm not arguing. I'm Jewish." And so, so what I'm saying, I'm actually very, I like to mentor people, but I like to tell them the truth, which is, and not be mean, but blunt. So the guy will send me cartoons and I'll say, they're okay. You know, in other words, they're not terrible. Which is actually a big leap from all the ideas that are terrible, but they're not good enough. I'm just saying they're not good enough. Reading an interesting book lately, you know, which says every college basketball player is in the 99.9 percentile of human basketball ability. And then there's the NBA. So it's not that severe in cartoon, but it's sort of the same kind of idea when you, what you have to be. Really good is often not good enough.
Takes me to your second lesson, the difference between professional and amateur. We're talking about cartoonists, we're talking about writing, talking about sports. Yeah. And there is a huge difference between professional and amateur in my mind, but what do you mean by it? How do you recognize the difference?
Well, I mean, the way I do it and say it in sort of a quip or an aphorism is a professional is dissatisfied, always dissatisfied. Mm-hmm. They always, it's never like, oh, I can't believe it. This is so great. I mean, analogous to athletics. You know, if a golfer is, you know, it's this idea of dedicated practice, always being a little bit dissatisfied with what you do. You know, Roger Federer played lousy yesterday, but even if he had played pretty well, even if he had won, he would be looking at everything he did wrong. He wouldn't be looking at the shots he did hit well. Mm-hmm. So I guess the difference between it is that, you know, an amateur is happy with everything they've done, and often they haven't done very much. Often amateurs, I mean, one of the things I used to say, if you send one cartoon to me as cartoon editor, you might as well have stamped amateur on it. You might as well have stamped amateur on it. You got to do one cartoon. I'll give you another funny anecdote about ideas. This is true. When I worked at the New Yorker, it was in, this was on 42nd Street in the Condé Nast building at that time. And really, the cartoonists were like a separate species, but that building was full of all, you know, all the magazines, executives, and whatever. And I was in the elevator with a guy, and it's like starting at like, I don't know, 20 or something. And he said, they stole my idea. Every floor down, he said, they stole my fucking idea. I can't believe they stole it. I mean, they just stole it from me. They fucking stole my idea. Finally, we get down to the bottom floor. I don't know this guy. I tap him on the shoulder. I say, get another idea.
And there's always another better idea.
Right. There's always another better idea. So that's the thing. There's always another better idea. You haven't reached the end of it, or there's a different idea, or this idea would lead to something else. The right professional attitude is humility. And even before you're a professional, the idea is, I've talked about the sweet spot between, you know, respect and disrespect. I mean, if you're showing cartoons to someone who supposedly knows what they're doing, has been in the business, respect their feedback they're giving you. Respect it. You know what I mean? Listen to it. Don't argue with it. Because I've never found anyone argue me into a laugh. Okay. Then I argue me into, oh, you're right. Okay. So
doesn't work.
I'd also realize that the person on the other side of the desk, even if they have all the credentials, might be wrong. But that's not the time to tell them they're wrong.
Speaking, you mentioned this point before. This is point number three. There are more problems caused by respect than disrespect. And you're saying to me, you know, you don't seek to offend people, but then don't fret over it. And then if people judge you wrongly and correctly, well, so what?
So, yeah, it used to be so what. Now they'll try to take your job away from you. Fortunately, I'm the president of a company, and they can't fire me. So it's on many levels. So I think you got to believe a little bit in your own talent in terms of don't be in awe. I was never in awe of what was done in the New York. I thought it was really great. And then I thought, yeah, but I can do it. But I can do it. You know, everybody who succeeds has to feel in some way that they can do it. So, and the other thing, in humor itself, disrespect is required. You're satirizing. The best of institutions are corrupt. The best. It's just the level of bureaucracy or corruption that exists, of covering your ass and covering the mistakes. Fortunately, in democracies, sometimes there's the balance where it works out, but you'll always find the rot there that is just what it is. So as a humorist, you're there to expose it. You're not there to praise it. Humor cannot praise anything. It always involves diminishment. It can't, it doesn't elevate. Its whole purpose is to bring down a notch, whether it's politicians or the professions in which it's satire or even ourselves. That's the point. And so that's why I say disrespect is good on that. In terms of offense, you know, that's a huge problem now, in which it used to be people who said they were offended, and you know, then I'd say, then what happened? Did you have lunch? Did you sleep okay? Sure, fine. Now they're saying they were microaggressed and have experienced trauma.
We used to call those hurty feelings, Bob. Now it's trauma.
Yeah, right. Hurty feelings, but it's often not even their feelings are hurt. They're wise, but it's the other people they're protecting whose feelings that they're protecting from being hurt. And really, it's good to have your feelings hurt. That's what they're for. That's why it's bad to have your body hurt, but it's okay to have your feelings hurt. That's about sticks and stones will break your bones. But just a little bit of resilience, a little bit of resilience.
All right. Point number four. This is important, I think. Talent is the ticket, but that's all. It gets you in.
I love sports and I play sports. And I think it's a wonderful foundation to think about things, especially like that. Whatever you've done in sports, like one of the sports, I play basketball and I play table tennis. And they're reasonably high level. But where I play is at a club here in Westchester, which is the biggest club in the Northeast. And there are professional tournaments every month. And you see these guys who were raised in China, who were born in China, live here now, who had trained 8 hours a day. And when you talk to any of them, they were selected. Mm-hmm. They didn't just train out. They were given tests, all sorts of weird coordination tests to show they had the ticket to benefit from 8 hours a day, 8 hours a day on footwork, 8 hours a day on every single thing. So there's always talent, you know. Let's say in terms of being funny. Now, I wouldn't even go in to say whether the talent is, you know, inborn or learned, but it's obviously a combination of both in sports. But in humor, I think it's something that has to happen very early for you to have this kind of mind, for one reason or another, that learns very early how symbols are manipulated, how ideas are manipulated, that has part of your mind that's processing things in a different way. And so that when you say, well, can people be taught to be funny? Well, everybody has learned to be funny. Everybody who is funny has somehow learned it in some way, but they started learning it very early. they started learning it very early. So the sports analogy is this. You want to take up skiing at 15? Good luck. You never get into the Olympics. Doesn't matter how many hours you put in. So you know, you will find out. And it's important to measure yourself in that, once again, if you're, since I've played sports and have played, you know, with different levels, whether it's pickup or at the club there, I've seen up close what professional looked like. You can't tell if you can hit a baseball by going through a batting cage. You know what I mean? You know, it's interesting also because the internet tells us a lot about talent. For instance, I can do Rubik's Cube. I sort of looked at it. I learned it. It takes me a minute or two. Hey, there's a kid in Japan who's doing it blindfolded in 11 seconds. Okay, he's got some other talent. It wasn't just practice. There was something there. Same thing with chess and all of these things. So talent's just your ticket. It's your ticket to the 10,000 hours, the 20,000 hours, or whatever. So the question is, do you want to punch that ticket? Mm-hmm. Most people don't want to punch the talent ticket. They don't want to punch it because that's the other side of it. It doesn't get, the talent doesn't get you in. It's a ticket for all the work. It's a ticket on a train that isn't a free ride. So that's that. Well, and that's what I found out also in terms of people who even wanted to be cartoonists and did have talent. They didn't want to punch that ticket, really. They didn't want to work that hard. It's another thing that I found out. I was very blessed to have parents that didn't care about me too much. They were older and they had been through depression, World War II. I came along late. The fact that, you know, my mother would put a mirror up to my mouth and I would fog up. That was like, good enough. He's breathing. And that's fine. And, you know, I didn't have to get outstanding. Satisfactory was okay. And so I could go my own way. They weren't praising. They loved me, but they weren't praising me all the time. We have a whole generation of people now raised on praise. Praise raised. As, you know, it's like the snowflake generation. As soon as they hit resistance, okay, they're the most talented kid in Peoria. And they come to New York, and that's where all the talented kids are coming, or any of the metropolitan hubs. And now they're up against everybody else, and they haven't experienced rejection. So I think the fact that my parents didn't hover over me in that way and didn't praise me, in fact, always were just like, because of the times they grew up in, they thought that the best kind of job you could actually get was a civil service job where they couldn't fire you. And you know, and this it was a funny story because I decided to become a cartoonist after I quit, you know, my psychology. And I told that to my parents, my mother and father. And my father looked at me sternly and said, you know, they already have people who do that. I said, yeah, I don't see any help wanted ads in the magazine that cartoonists wanted. But I said, besides that, one of them might die. And then all I got to do is read the obituaries. As soon as a cartoonist dies, I'll be right there. So, but here's the other thing. I didn't put this in a lesson. So still my parents supported me. In other words, so when I quit to do that, I mean, the big thing was always, why can't you do something else? And so you have something to fall back on. And I'm totally against falling back on anything. I'm totally against falling back. If you're going to go for one of these things, go for it. Because otherwise your mind is going to be divided and you're going to be amazed at how quickly you're back to where you need to fall back to. But they supported me. Of course, I really wasn't making money. And my father, who had done pretty well, you know, would send me $200 a month. You know what I mean? So, you know, in other words, they still backed me. And that's the thing I would advise also, you know, parents who find the kid who was supposed to be the lawyer wants to be the artist. The kid who was supposed to be the lawyer, she wants to be a singer and stuff. Support them, you know, support them. Give them, let them take a shot at it. Let them take a shot at it.
Okay, that takes us to lesson number five. Don't rue, don't stew. And I think you were talking about how rejection isn't something, rejection isn't personal, it's just necessary.
Right. And I remember they would talk to the moth, which is like this, you know, audio where you tell a story about, and I told a story about, you know, about rejections, about the benefits of rejection in terms of building your resilience, in terms of perfecting your art, in terms of understanding that the world is not your oyster, especially when you're young and you come at it and everything, and it's been pretty much a glide path from you, especially if you've had a good education and all of that and done well. But then in the end, as a joke, I said, believe me, rejection will make you a better person. Look how much better a person it made me. And so that was my snarky little joke on it. It's the annealing fire. It hardens you. And that's what you need. You need to be not mean to succeed, but tough.
You remind me of a joke, talking about your parents. Leo Buscaglia was a psychologist. He wrote a bunch of popular books in the 80s or 90s. And he was raised in Italy, and he decided he wanted to go see the world. His parents said, Leo, don't do it. And he said, but he did anyway. So he traveled around France and Italy, and he studied at the feet of Jean-Paul Sartre. And eventually he ran out of money, as a kid would. So he cobbles enough money together to sends his mother a telegraph and says, Dear Mama, starving, Leo. And he waits around all day for the reply to come back, and it does. And the reply was from his mother was, Dear Leo, starve, Mama. And it's that sort of, and he said it was the best thing for him because it forced him to go to that next step in his maturation and his individuation as a person. Yeah, I hope that it's true.
Well, yeah, well, I mean, it's funny because parents, it's interesting. They'll say one thing, but they really believe another. The thing, I don't know, in my group anyway, my mother would say, we don't care what you do. We don't care if you're a garbage man, as long as you're the best garbage man. And I said, Mom, in the city of New York, you have over 12,000 garbage men. That's hard. I'll go into cartooning.
Yeah. And well, okay, so don't rue, don't stew when you encounter failure. And you said to me, too, your signal must be louder than the noise because, you know, there's a lot of noise out there in the world, and it's a very competitive, everything is competitive nowadays.
Right.
So there's lots of noise, lots of static, and it's very hard to have a unique signal.
And that also comes out of work. You know, it's dependent on the level of success. And as cartoon editor, I might buy a gag from someone because a gag stands by itself. And sure, that's great. The person got in the New Yorker. But are they going to continue to produce? And is there a particular voice? You know, is there a sensibility? Is there something different about what they are doing, at least different enough so that they have a signature way of thinking and drawing? Because that is part of the pleasure. Part of the pleasure of anything really is the human context. You get to know this person, this cartoonist. You've enjoyed them before, this comedian, this singer. So everything they do is not anew, right? It has the whole penumbra of their other things and that builds in, but only if you have a unique, if it's all generic. You can have, you know, you could have generic good jokes, but they just remain generic. So you don't get that extra level of pleasure you get from voice, from, you know, from personality and all of that. I mean, it all comes down to work and, you know, it's not just the work of producing the thing. It's the cognitive work, the cognitive lift of devoting your mind space to doing it. So you have to do a lot to find out what it is you do. And you have to think a lot just to end up doing anything. So mm-hmm. a lot of times it doesn't look like you're doing anything. A lot of times you're not doing anything, or it doesn't look like it, but your unconscious is doing something because you're focused. So one way I put it is boredom is really important. If you're not bored, you shouldn't be entertained by something. Look, most of the time you're not going to have ideas, okay? So what is the other time? Well, you're trying to get ideas and nothing is coming and you're bored. In other words, you're unhappy. They're the birth pains of ideas. That's your unconscious actually working. That uncomfortableness that you feel is very useful, because then when you do get the idea, when you do get the ideas, they feel that much better. They've relieved that very unpleasant state of having no idea. So this sort of almost bipolar or bimodal, at least, way is, it's the sort of wavelength of creativity. And even to some extent, mood and emotionality, the highs and lows that you have. I think often in a creative field, you're not feeling that great. That's why it's a burden. It's a burden to be in that field. Mm-hmm. It's like you produce the thing and now you're back to where you were, sort of. I mean, but there are tricks and there are all things you could do. But often you're stymied at any particular moment. So at any particular moment, you're actually not a cartoonist. You're just like everybody else. Most of the time, you're not a cartoonist. You don't have an idea. So where you're better is that 100% of the time, the other people aren't cartoonists. So the fact that you're a cartoonist 2% of the time is enough. But I don't even like to hang out mentally with all those other people who aren't cartoonists 98% of the time. Get lost. So, I mean, I'm making jokes about it, but it's absolutely true. So one of the things about getting ideas is it's important not to be overstimulated by the outside. That's why you go someplace. That's why you have a studio. That's why it's a horrible environment now in some ways, because you can constantly be distracted by like everything that comes down the pike. You know what I mean? But I mean, it's interesting when people try to think, they often close their ideas. They try to, they try to reduce stimulation. So when you look, you have stimulation, and of course you have stimulation naturally all the time. I never got ideas at parties. I was at a party, I was talking and stuff, but all that experience is filtering through. And then when you eliminate that outside stimulation, it's your inside stimulation that will make the connection.
Point number six, and you mentioned this before, originality is overrated.
Yeah, it depends on the field. If the field is, the only thing about it is that it's original, and that's often the field in art, and you know, which is bullshit, but that's just me. Kid from Queens saying, yeah, okay, I've never seen it. I don't know, for some reason you decided to Julian Schnabel to take plates and throw them against the wall and glue them on canvas, I guess. But what I mean is that popular forms, songs, and theater and movie and humor is based on previous forms. It's always within the cocoon of familiarity that you make something new. For someone who's never seen these forms, everything would look pretty much identical in terms of pop music from any decade. They hadn't seen it. If you took someone from the 18th century and you played Beatles or Elvis Presley or Sam Cooke, they'd say, well, it's pretty much all the same. Isn't it? You know, just like if you don't know anything about classical music, it pretty much sounds all the same. So I'm saying once you know that, you work with those forms. You work with the classic tropes in cartoons. It could be mountain climbers, desert island, couples in bed, wise man on the mountain. All of those things are done before, and people will see them just like most jokes have a form before. And that's what people like. It's your job often within a form to create some novelty that works. And that is very hard. It does give you a leg up in that you know where to start. And from that, you may gradually get to something that is very different from that form. But only by, I guess it's the old saw, you've got to learn the rules to break the rules. You've got to learn the rules to break the rules. If you don't know it at all, it's really easy to create something no one has ever seen before and you think is funny and they'll say, what? You know what I mean?
Well, I know that in business, when companies create products, if the product is too original, if it's too exotic, if it's too foreign, if it's too far, if it's too much, the consumers won't buy it because there's no connection. They don't relate to it. It just seems more of an oddity to them. And businesses have learned the hard way. The way you put it was, originality must be born within the cocoon of familiarity. There must be some sort of...
Right. Yeah, for popular forms. But there is real originality that we don't respond to immediately in art, and then eventually we do. But it's because we become familiar with it. It's not the first time. It's interesting also that because there's another phenomenon, and this would be true of, for example, sitcoms. Seinfeld was one of the great sitcoms of all time. You know, a friend of mine said, hey, it's funny. And I saw it. I said, yeah, it's okay. I liked it.
Yeah.
But I didn't like it nearly as much as I was going to like it once I became familiar with it. Once I became familiar with its forms, with, you might think, because it's interesting in that the familiarity with seeing the same, with seeing Kramer come in that door, with understanding who George was, who Jerry was, who Elaine was, and what they were going to do, added pleasure to it. You like to see the people do their thing. So to some extent, every episode was sort of like the previous episode, but also different. Mm-hmm. Familiarity built and built and built. And anyway, so that's what I think.
Lesson number 7, appreciate when good is good enough.
Well, I mean, in business, I've found that, I've got this website, cartoonstock.com, plug there. You read, and I've created a cartoon brand for the New York, before the New York and the New Yorker Board of Film. So you work on these websites, you get into the deep weeds and everything. You get obsessed with the little things that you keep trying to make better, and you realize, This is a diminishing return zone here. This is not a thing that has to be perfect. It just has to be good enough to what it's supposed to do. Which is different than if I'm writing the caption. I want that caption to be as good as it be, because it's a whole other standard. But even in putting out the magazine, you might not have, you look at the cartoons again and think, oh, it's so good, but still, you needed 17 cartoons. In the end, this was the team you're going with, and this is what you actually have to produce. So it's the exigencies of, you don't have a deadline and you don't have this demand for it to be on a newsstand or something, then you can fiddle forever. Once you do, you have to cut bait. You have to do it. And so then you have to say, it's good enough. But also you can just waste. You got to realize when you're just wasting your time going down, you become obsessed with a particular thing that you feel you absolutely have to get right. And it's just a question of moving on. In some ways, that's why, let's say, the magazine with the editor like David Remnant, the important thing about the editor, it's important that they make good decisions, but probably the most important thing is that they make decisions.
You put it to me this way, is stop making it better sooner rather than later, but better.
Yeah.
Which I
right.
like.
Well, yeah, so I had put it better before. Stop making it better sooner. And so right in your mind at the beginning, have that idea, right? That you can stop this now, because otherwise there's a kind of momentum. There's a kind of apparatus you may have arranged in some sort of business that people have said, okay, you're supposed to, okay, would you please, when is that? And then you realize, it's going to be embarrassing, but let's stop. You know, let's stop, because there are these social networks that you've set up and sort of pressures on you in terms of, but you said we were going to do this. And you're not a politician. You can say, but it was a bad idea. I changed my mind. Most of that's hard for people to say, hard for everyone to say, right? To say, oh, the idea I was so excited about that was a good idea is bad. It never happens in politics, and it rarely happens in business. But it could happen in my business, because it's not a corporation. And in corporations, I think it's the last thing in the world that can happen.
Unfortunately, yes. Admitting failures or mistakes seems to be against the grain for some reason. Well, let me move on to lesson number 8. We're talking about recognition. Find your sweet spot of fame. You were mentioning sweet spot earlier.
Yeah. I mean, I told you this anecdote when I was on, it was a Nightline show about when I became cartoon editor in 97, and my daughter was, I think, 6 at the time, and she was there. She said, Daddy, are you famous? And I said, to someone who's famous, I'm a nobody, and to a nobody, I'm famous. Yeah. And so and I said, that's not a bad sweet spot to be in. I didn't tell her that, she was only 6, but where you don't feel famous, but you get some cred for being known, it helps you. It's a card that you can play. It's a card that you should play. You know, I play the card. I was cartoon editor of the New Yorker that to some extent why you have me on this podcast. And that's a nice amount of credibility to have, but it's not overwhelming. It doesn't distort your life in any way. It makes people admire you, but not so much that it's creepy. You know, they're not like fans of celebrity. I don't have to worry about anyone stalking me.
I've never heard of a cartoonist being stalked. That's true. That's your good point.
So I think that's a good thing and that's also a line of when it's a good thing to be known. It's a good thing to have some degree of renown and tiny bit of celebrity within a small world, but that's plenty good enough so that your life doesn't get distorted. I feel sorry for people who are celebrities in a way. They have so far to fall. They have so far to fall. Whereas if you're a little thing and you wrote some books and you stuff like that, it's not going so good for you. Well, it was never that high to start with. You can still be a normal person.
Does the sweet spot hold true for wealth as well?
I think absolutely. Absolutely. You know, the amounts of wealth we have some people having are bizarre and distorting. And probably not good for society either. But I would think absolutely. Because then you become a king. You know what I mean? A king, and it's a bad, heavy hand for the head that wears that kind of crown and everything. You don't have a normal life anymore. You know, you're not normal because of where you put in. And also there's nothing you can spend it on. So I do think, I think there's studies that show sort of the curve of sort of a certain amount of money does make you happier, but beyond that, I'll tell you, because it's in a nice house, I have a pool, the lights at night that weren't working in the pool, they went out. So, shit. So we got to replace the lights. Really? $3,000? Okay, fuck. I can, why do you want $3,000? Like, what are they going to have scuba divers go down there and put in these lights? And one of the lights are put in there and they're supposed to change color, like a little show. And I'm in the pool. At that point, I don't care about it. And my wife said, they're not changing color. I said, oh, yeah. So look, even there, now I've found my way to be unhappy because I had $3,000 to spend on these silly pool lights that aren't working. So imagine that you're enormously wealthy. You got the 800-foot yacht that somehow the balls in the bowling alley aren't coming back the way they were supposed to. and now you're totally pissed. Look, I didn't fucking get this bowling alley on my yacht, so it wasn't going to work. I don't care if I don't bowl. That doesn't matter. It's the principle of the thing. I want my yacht bowling alley to be perfect and certainly better than Bezos's yacht bowling alley.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So I think that, you know, you will find really, really unhappy wealthy people because of the, and in a way that that sort of blends over to be careful what you care about very much. Anything that you decide to become a connoisseur of, you're going to mostly be unhappy with. It's never going to, if all of a sudden you're a coffee connoisseur, almost every cup of coffee you have is going to be shitty. I mean, really, it's terrible. You just, you go there, you, I don't know, it was, it had body, but I didn't like the notes. You know, all of a sudden that's coffee. When I grew up, everybody just drank the coffee. But now, because I got to, see, I'm already in that place because we had the little Keurig thing, it broke. And my wife said, why don't we use the French press? I said, okay, let's use the French press. And then, this is better. Now I can't go back. I can't have the other coffee. Now I've always got to have the French press coffee. In a way, it's like all of these things are, Jack Siegel had a funny cartoon in which there's a couple on a road and you see the road sign. It says, enchantment, the gateway to disenchantment.
But it's true. It's true.
No, it's true. So so there it is. So I guess that's my idea. Look for the sweet spot when enough, when good enough is good enough. You know what I mean? And I just thought of this. I don't even know what it means exactly, but I do think through this humorous lens is sometimes treat yourself to something really bad. Treat yourself to something really bad. You think that coffee Keurig is bad? Have some real bad coffee. Now it won't seem so bad. Instead of constantly looking for better, 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 sometimes shift your perspective, move it around.
To recalibrate your taste, yes. I can see the logic of that.
Yeah, recalibrate your taste. You know, all of a sudden I hardly smoke cigars. Every once in a while I do. And I went to the cigar place and I like these David Ott cigars because I like the way they burn, because they burn completely perfect. And so now I'm a guy who can't smoke a cigar that the ash doesn't look right.
Yeah.
Because you know, the ash doesn't look right.
You're a Connecticut shade on the outside kind of guy, Bob. I can tell. Yeah. That's the kind of cigar.
And then I said, shit, really? $27 for a cigar? This is getting a little bit out of hand. You know what I mean? It's a little bit out of hand. And so anyway, so that's, I think, all related.
So that takes us to lesson number 9. Play the cards you're dealt, but know the game you're in.
Right. I was dealt a card of being fine. And I played it. So I didn't really have two choices to play it. I could have done stand-up, which would have been a little hard because I was a little bit older than most of the people who got into it, being born in 44. So when you really had comedy clubs by, 72, 73, and I think that would have been a game where my card really wouldn't have worked. My comedy card wouldn't work because I was also combining it because I was funny enough, but then it was just being funny, wasn't combining with the art thing or my philosophy or other ideas. I don't think I would have had that connection to people that's necessary to be really successful at stand-up. A lot of people can do stand-up successful. So the game I played was the game that combined my talents. That was the game I played. So you've got to know that the game... You have to know the game you're in and whether you have those cards. But in general, play every card you have. If you're good looking, make yourself a little even better looking. It's better. You know what I mean? If you're fit, become fit. Whatever it is, people are going to judge you. They're going to look at your place in the hierarchy and they're going to judge you by a million different things. Everything that you got good about you, make better. And understand how to use it. Because I also use humor. For instance, if you have humor, play that card, and it doesn't mean professionally. It will put people at ease. It will show that you are confident. It will let people bond to you if you use it correctly. So let's say you have it, you know, so when people say, well, you know, in terms of using humor in business, I go back to the talent thing. I said, you need to have a talent for it. Okay, if you have that talent, use it. If you don't have a talent for it, it's not going to work. And a lot of people have more of that talent within that game. The business game doesn't demand much humor at all. It demands just a little bit to be playful, a little bit to make the slightly relieving comment. That shows you confidence. It's not an out-and-out joke. See what I mean? To play that. So you have that card for that game. That doesn't mean you go into stand-up. That doesn't mean that, you know, that's, so I think that's the way you look at it. And, you know, and everybody plays the cards where they should play the cards they have and just know the game they're in. Now, that doesn't mean, it doesn't always mean that you're going to achieve wealth or success by that. I mean, this is sort of like tricks for appearing smart when you're not.
Yes, go on. I'm ready to write this down, please. Yes.
You. Direct the conversations of things you know. Just direct the conversations of things you know well, and people will be very impressed. And try to move it away from things you don't know too well to things you do. Of course, it's better if you know more than, you know, baseball statistics or something. But a little bit of knowledge about a lot of things, you know, that can be
brought up. I say, okay, so they're talking about the exchange rate mechanism. Now I got to shift it to basketball. Okay, that's a good tip. I'll be doing that.
Yeah, right.
You also made the point, though, you know, you're dealt cards in life and you play the cards you're dealt with. But also, and bearing in mind that depending on the game, sometimes two of a kind will win, you know, and that's not a hard hand to get.
Well, that's what I mean. In business, the two of a kind for being funny will win. It shows you're relaxed, you know, and it could be the slightest thing, you know, that you say about a meeting, about it can be self-deprecating. I'm going to show you a lot of boring slides, so let's get to it, you know, or something, just something that it can be just so easy and simple. It can simply be you moving out of a completely serious frame, smile, to talk with the people before the meeting in a relaxed, friendly way in which humor will often come out about, you know, just think, what is everything that it's perfectly okay to bitch about here? And then open that up, and then people will enjoy that. So I'm just saying that's where two of a kind can... Well, in a way, it's even true everywhere. You never know the lottery you're in, or in terms of talent, maybe it's not two of a kind, but the exact same cartoon that might come in one week and wouldn't make the cut would make it another week.
Well, that's the point. You don't have to be dealt a royal flush in the cards of life in order to succeed. You have the cards right. You have, and you can deal with them, and you probably have more than enough to do well, is what I'm hearing you say.
Right. You have more than enough to do well. You have to look for the different kinds of spots. Could be businesses. It could be, you know, it could be, I'm not right for this corporation, but maybe I'm perfect for a smaller organization. So I've had exactly that same situation where there was an employee who really took a lot on himself and did a good job, but took so much on it and things didn't necessarily work out, and it wasn't really his fault. And it was partly because the organization was just too small to absorb that thing that didn't work out. Whereas a bigger organization, they would have been perfect because they would have gone on to the next project. It wouldn't have been a big deal. It might not have been as important. So it's not always, you know, the analogy maybe doesn't hold always with cards, royal flush, two of a kind. Sometimes it's just the variety of abilities that are right for one place rather than the other. And those are your cards, those are your attributes. You have to try to find the right fit. I mean, one of the things I realized is that which is why now I've gone on with my own business, is that I was just a cartoonist all those years, and I started the Cartoon Bank. That was my own business. Then I sold out to New Yorker, and I became a cartoon editor or a cartoonist there. But at that point, I was in a big corporation. And even though I had a lot of success there, it wasn't really the right spot for me. I didn't really get there till I was 15 in Maverick all my life. And looking back on it, I can see, oh man, that's a whole other game. That is another game. That's a game of siloed information, and where bluntness is not valued. I mean, I got through it, and I benefited enormously from it. But I realized that I realized part of the dissatisfaction, I was always dissatisfied in a way, because I realized it's a corporation, and corporations will make decisions. They'll be, you know, all of a sudden there's, you know, you're doing something, and then somebody somewhere changes something. And at one point, when I left the Cartoon Bank and they gave it to lawyers or other people, and then they'd have people come in, I was still sort of consulting them. And every person who came in before they left, Five would say, failure is not an option. And as soon as they came in and said failure wasn't an option, I knew they were going to fail right away. but that's what a corporation is.
Well, that takes us to the lesson number 10 about speaking of corporations and of offices. Lesson number 10, the office will always be there. Your talent and opportunity won't.
Right. So that's use your you. In other words, for most people who are talented and also intelligent, there's always an office job. There's always a corporation. You know what I mean? The ability to travel light and to burn bright, stay up all night. I don't know, I feel like I'm going to do a rap here. Stay up all night is a gift of the young. You know what I mean? To just be in your 20s and you get a break. And that break means no sleep. That break means, you know, traveling across the country. That means doing this and that means doing that. And you're traveling like you don't have a family and you don't have a baby and you don't have anything. And you feel sort of invulnerable in, you know, physically. It's not bad. You don't have a bad back. You don't have acid reflux. You don't have anything. You don't have to see, well, where's the pharmacy out here in the Mojave?
I mean, where's the toilet, please?
Where's the toilet? Right. Where's the toilet? You know what I mean? So you got to use that time. That's your booster rocket to get you into orbit. It doesn't work out. You're 32 or whatever. And then, you know what? You know, go to monster.com. You'll find something. It'll be there. And so the office will always be there. And I've been saying that for many years to all the kids who I met. The office will always be there. You know, give it everything you've got while you've got it.
What do you think of this? I would elaborate on that a little bit. And I say people ought to use their youth at any age, at any stage of their life. You know, right, you know, you don't have to subscribe to being elderly and infirm and enfeebled, you know, right. A lot of people do. But I think it's useful to accurately assess your age and stage of life, because all, you know, there are certain opportunities available to you and I now at our stage of life than were not available to us when we were in our 20s. So each age and stage brings something new and novel and good.
Okay, so here are my three jokes. Well, one thing is humor helps you cope with getting old. So when I was 70, I created these three jokes, not cartoons, just jokes. I said, I'm 70. The good news is it could be worse. The bad news is it will be. I'm 70. The good news is 70 is the new 50. The bad news is dead is not the new alive. And I'm 70. And when you're 70 and you're a guy, you wake up stiff everywhere but where you want to be. So I think you're right, though. But I'm saying that in a way. But it is important to understand, I think you're right, that you... standards, things you do, that's the way you spend your time. Your time is limited. You're mortal. The time is limited. How do you want to spend it? You know what I mean? How do you want to spend it? So maybe you don't spend it on what you spent it on before. You don't have to hold every standard that you had before and think you're a failure because you're not meeting that. I mean, I ran marathons when I was, you know, 30 pretty well. I'm not going to do that at 77. I'm not going to look at my Apple Watch and say, gee, how come I mean, a joke I just made up talking to someone because I had problems with my shoulder and, you know, some other physical problems, just minor. But I said, I thought I'd go to the doctor and they do extensive tests and say, "We've done extensive tests, Mr. Mankoff, and we found the problem. You're 77. I think there is a kind of wisdom that comes to it, in that you intuitively understand bullshit, you know, things that are real, things that aren't. I'm sort of middle road kind of guy. You know, when people tell me there's going to be a Green New Deal and it's going to have to last 30 or 40 years, consistently, people doing these policies. And I'll say, well, that means the same people have to keep getting elected. I have never seen people keep getting elected. Mm. How can you think this is possible? You know, everybody who's had experience knows this is a fantasy.
Yeah.
It can't possibly happen. It can't possibly happen because in democracy, so it's just sort of this knowledge of things you've seen. When people are predicting about the future, and, you know, what I know is that I can't remember anybody who predicted anything during my lifetime. I mean, people predict all sorts of things that actually turned out.
Yeah,
I don't know.
It's unlikely.
So I think when you're in the moment, you suffer from, people do when they just had that moment, from chronocentrism. They feel like this is the truth. Mm-hmm. This is the moment for the first time that people actually understand everything. They never understand anything. We can talk about this a lesson, is that more, it's a little bit like the disrespect, respect thing. More harm is done by smart people than stupid people. Much more harm is done by smart people than stupid people.
Yeah.
People don't have the levers. They don't have the power. They don't have anything, really. It's smart people who really think that they know the world. I mean, going back to endlessly to my sports analogy, big sports fan, I know a lot of statistics, believe me, I know all this stuff. Now, here's a universe we actually have data for. We actually have statistics. We know a lot about it, and we can't predict it. Is the world easier than the NBA to predict? Is the world easier, or are there more variables? Seems like there might be more. And now you're looking at this little universe that you're actually an expert on. If you're a fan, you know more about the NBA than any politician knows about any country. You actually know more. And yet, what happened? So, I mean, that's one of the benefits, I think, that my daughter just says, "You're cranky, that's all." But
as if there's something wrong with that, Bob. Yeah. What is she trying to say?
Yeah, no, I think that, you know, it's the same thing. You should be idealistic in your youth, or else nothing ever changes. But if you're still idealistic when you're, you know, when you've been through the mill, when you missed the lesson.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's finish up with one last question for you. We've been talking a lot about the things, wisdom, things that you've learned in life. What is one lesson what is something that you have unlearned maybe lately? Something you absolutely positively knew to be true then, but now know is not the case.
Well, I unlearn a lot of things just by forgetting them. So as you get older, although I have very strong opinions, like I've just said, I sort of unlearned or unfelt, even as I performatively spout them, I unlearned my confidence in them, a kind of humility. To some extent, I unlearned my egotism, which made me successful. I unlearned that part of it. Or maybe it's really learning. It's learning. I'm not a guy who throughout my life brimmed with humility. So it's sort of, it's unlearning. I would say to some extent, it's unlearning. I can make it more specific. All the tricks, just like I said to you, okay, how to manipulate the conversation, how to make yourself seem smarter, how to in every way, you know, focus so much on my tricks in a way to dominate, to enforce my personality on people or things, to get my way, because it's no longer at my age satisfactory to me. I don't really want to do that. I some of that, when I look at that, was useful to me. And some of it was hormonal, you know, having to do when you're younger and you got testosterone, and you're aggressive. Everything is you want to win. You want to win. And from sports to every single argument. And so I've absolutely unlearned, hey, I don't have to win this argument with my daughter. I don't have to win an argument with anybody. Mm-hmm. I don't have to win an argument. And that's hard for me because it's natural for me to a part of my mind automatically marshal my forces, my armamentarium, everything. So I spent a lifetime learning how to always do that. And so I've unlearned that, or, you know, damped it down. You know what I mean? I see that as it got me where I am, but it's not going to get me where I want to go for the rest of my life to be that way.
Okay, we'll finish on that note. You've been listening to the podcast, 10 Lessons It Took Me 50 Years to Learn. Our guest today has been legendary, famed cartoonist Bob Mantoff. My name is Duff Watkins. You've heard from us. We'd like to hear from you. Email us. The address is podcast@10lessonslearned.com. That's podcast@10lessonslearned.com. Tell us what you think. Tell us who you'd like us to talk to. This episode is produced by Robert Hosrey and is sponsored by the Professional Development Forum PDF. You can find them online, professionaldevelopmentforum.org. They offer webinars, social media discussions, podcast parties, anything you want, everything you need, and it's all free. Professional Development Forum. Oh, and while you're at it, go ahead and hit that subscribe button. That way you won't miss any episode. And after all, this is the podcast on the internet that makes the world a wiser place, lesson by lesson. Thanks for listening.